Whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Michael Williams reached a plea bargain with the state for 8 years and long-term treatment. He pleaded guilty to 8 years and long-term treatment, but neither the trial court, who sentenced him to long-term treatment, nor his trial attorney checked to see if he was eligible for long-term treatment, which he was not. Under Section 217.362, the trial court is to notify the Department of Corrections to screen the defendant for long-term treatment before sentencing. Had the trial court checked, as he should have done, and discovered that Mr. Williams was not eligible for long-term treatment, the court could have offered Mr. Williams the option to withdraw his guilty plea. In fact, the court told Mr. Williams during the plea colloquy that if I don't sentence you to what you've bargained for, you will have the option to withdraw your plea.
So it was not an open plea, it was a binding plea agreement.
It was a binding plea agreement, Your Honor, and I have tendered to this court a copy as a supplemental legal file, which you all have taken with the case, that motion. It's not a petition to plead guilty. It's really just one of those memos that you sign at the bench. But everybody signed it, and it says the sentence is 8 years and long-term treatment.
And the state argues long-term treatment if eligible. Was there anything in the written statement of the plea agreement or during the plea colloquy that had the limitation, if eligible?
Not if eligible, Your Honor. The judge, of course, went through, you know, I'm not promising that you'll get out. You have to complete this. That's why I think this is different than some of the cases that the state has cited that say you're not guaranteed probation. And you're not. And he was not guaranteed getting out after long-term treatment. But what the statute says is that the court has to check to see if the defendant is eligible. And no one checked to see if he was eligible. And this court has actually ruled this very issue in a habeas case, State ex rel Taylor v. Moore. The facts are almost identical, although it's a habeas. And in fact,
isn't the major difference what the factual findings were in that case as it relates to prejudice?
Well, I think
not there was any prejudice, not in Taylor the master found there was, but in this case the motion court found there wasn't any prejudice.
Well, actually in this case the motion court found that there was a reasonable person would not have proceeded to trial rather than to take this sentence even if he'd known he wasn't eligible. As to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and I think that raises an interesting question as to what the standard of prejudice is for my point one, which is a due process claim, because we know it's not Strickland, it's not Hill v. Lockhart. Those are ineffective assistance of counsel claims. The habeas cases from this court, such as Taylor v. Moore and the one I supplemented, Nixon v. Campbell, which was in the amended motion, seem to suggest that an involuntary guilty plea, a plea is involuntary if the defendant did not receive the benefit of his bargain. So I think this is more of a Santabello type issue.
But the court here did find that he got the benefit of his bargain and found he was not credible as to the fact that he would not have pled guilty. You have both those two findings that you have to deal with.
Because I think the findings talk about prejudice from the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, but the findings made as to the court claim were only that it is not cognizable, and this court decided that opposite to that in the Taylor case. Now,
in Santabello, the United States Supreme Court sent the case back to determine whether or not there should be specific performance or whether or not that the relief sought by the petitioner required the opportunity to withdraw his plea. So to me, that suggests that maybe there could be a prejudice analysis conducted at the lower court.
I do think that that's an interesting question, Your Honor. And what I want to look, what I wanted to point out about the findings is that they're not very specific to Mr. Williams. The findings of the court say that that he, it is clear from the record he received the benefit of his bargain with the state, which is incorrect, and that. His testimony at the plea hearing leaves the court convinced he did not have a factual dispute that would necessitate a trial, which just says whether the plea is voluntary or not, rendering his testimony without credibility. So it reads as if it's an objective standard that because he pleaded guilty, because leaving the court with no factual determinations for a guilty for a trial, then that then there's
what
no...
What if the plea agreement instead of long-term treatment would have been, assume that the defendant was from Northwest Missouri and that the and that generally defendants from Northwest Missouri end up in the Cameron facility so that they can have family visits, and that that was the plea agreement and everybody agreed and everybody said, okay, we agree, it's 8 years to be served in Cameron, and either there was a really bad storm and Cameron isn't available or it's just full. And so the defendant gets sent somewhere else within the time to file a post-conviction motion. Would that be set aside?
I think it depends on if it's really part of the plea bargain or not. And I think
let's
we're getting
assume I'm assuming it was. I'm okay. Assuming that it was every bit a part of this a plea agreement that long-term treatment was. It just ends up that it's a factual impossibility as opposed to a legal impossibility.
Then I think we would look for whether there's a reasonable basis in the record for a mistaken belief on the part of the defendant. And that's not exactly how this was raised in this case, but you know, this court touched on that in the Delph case. Neither has cited it.
But for purposes of due process and get the benefit of your bargain, how is it any different? We're talking about something other than the actual sentence, and we're talking about either a plan or a place that the judge nor none of the lawyers nor the defendant may have any control over.
That's why I think your hypothetical, Your Honor, is closer to the Delphi Missy case, because in that case this court held that that if it wasn't part of the sentence, then it wasn't really a Santabello issue. I think, and Delph cited the Nixon v. Campbell case favorably and said, you know, that's still good law, but we're going to make a distinction between something that's not part of the sentence and something, I think in Delph it was a condition of probation that we were talking about. In this case, we're not talking about a condition of probation or whether he's serving his sentence in Cameron. We're talking about the sentence itself. This is not whether he gets out on probation. This is whether he gets in. This was.
Well, what if he didn't? What if he had the requisite number of convictions, but that the program was just full?
That's closer to Nixon v. Campbell. In that case, the program had been discontinued, mm-hmm. and the defendant could no longer go into that program.
Or a funding deficiency.
Right. So the program had been discontinued. It wasn't the defendant's fault that he'd violated his probation, but in that case, this court held, it's not his fault that he's violated probation, but it's still a violation even though the program no longer exists. But this court recognized he should have been given the opportunity to withdraw his plea. Actually, in that case, he was given the opportunity to withdraw his plea, and this court held that's why it was an error to revoke the probation in that case.
But didn't the trial court essentially make that finding here, that while there wasn't an affirmative statement by the defendant that he wanted to withdraw his plea, the trial court essentially found at the hearing that he would have pled guilty anyway. He wouldn't have wanted to withdraw his plea, even if the long-term treatment program wasn't on the table.
I mean, the court said he didn't think there was a factual dispute that would necessitate a trial, so he didn't think there was credibility for a request to vacate the plea and go to trial. Whether or not Mr. Williams would have wanted to withdraw his plea, I mean, that's still what he's asking to do. Now, I realize that finding is in the findings, which is one reason I'm not talking about the ineffective assistance of counsel claim very much, because I I have no illusions that this court's going to reverse that line of cases.
So to show prejudice, does the movement have to show that he would not have pled guilty at all, or he would not have pled guilty to this particular plea deal?
I think that he would not have pled guilty to this particular plea deal. I mean, we know after Missouri v. Frye that the plea bargaining process is part of and that's an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, but we know that now you no longer have to just say there would have been a trial. You can say you would have taken a different plea bargain, you would have taken a different offer. There's other forms of prejudice now that then just that you would have gone to trial. And I think that's why I think the prejudice for this claim, you know, there's Court of Appeals opinions, which aren't binding on this court, but there's Court of Appeals opinions that say a plea is involuntary if you didn't get the benefit of your bargain. Now, I'm not sure logically I see that because this error really happened before sentencing. I mean, what should have happened is he shows up, the prosecutor offers him 8 years in long-term treatment. His attorney says, you get 8 years in long-term treatment. She didn't check either. He shows up and he pleads guilty to that. At that point, I think that's a voluntary plea. The error occurs when the judge then doesn't, before sentencing, check to see if he's eligible, which is why I have a little logical problem with whether not the benefit of his bargain making the plea involuntary, but that's the language that's been used.
Is it more like the cases that say the judge sentenced him to a sentence that's not authorized by law?
That's what this court said in Taylor v. Moore. In Taylor v. Moore, this court said the defendant was prejudiced by an unlawful sentence. That's one of the first lines in that opinion.
But we are stuck with the problem, or we're left with the problem, that the trial court didn't see the bargain the way you see it. The trial court thought it was clear that all he had bargained for was a request for long-term treatment, not a guarantee of long-term treatment.
The trial court sentenced him. It's in the judgment and sentence that he's
being
sentenced.
No, I'm talking about the motion court.
Oh, the motion court.
The record is clear that he was to participate in long-term treatment if eligible. The fact is highlighted by the court's use of the term requests.
But the statute requires the judge to check for eligibility.
I think it's unlawful to sentence him to that without first checking.
Unlawful to sentence him to that without first checking.
Because the statute imposes that.
If, in fact, the motion court found that he pled if eligible, is there anything in the record that supports that?
That he pled if eligible? No. The word eligibility doesn't appear in the plea colloquy. He says, you know, I can't make you the promise that you're going to get out, which is more, like I said, akin to the cases that say you're not guaranteed release on probation.
But where's the word request in the sentence?
I think it's in the judgment. Let me look. It's in the judgment.
And can you read that sentence to us?
Yes. Per recommendation of the prosecuting attorney and acceptance of plea agreement by defendant, the court follows said agreement, sentences defendant to 8 years, court requests defendant be enrolled in alcohol drug appropriate treatment program with the Department of Corrections under 217-362.
So he does say he accepts it where it was definite, but then he says requests. So
he does
why
say
doesn't that.
That
undercut your argument that it was an essential part of the plea?
Because he told the defendant if he didn't accept that he could withdraw his plea, and that's all he's asking for now.
Well, he sentenced him in accordance with the plea.
He sentenced him in accordance
with
the plea.
So that's not in dispute. The dispute is what happens if there is either a legal or possibly a practical complication that doesn't allow that portion other than the sentence to be followed through with.
It's more than just a legal impossibility. We have a court that didn't follow the statute. It's different than the program. It's different than the case where the program was dissolved after sentencing.
What you're saying is the statute requires the judge to have determined eligibility before entering a sentence that includes referral to the program.
That's the plain language of the statute, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The appellant raised two points, but both of them were premised on a claim that the appellant's guilty plea was rendered involuntary, both by the trial court's failure, the plea court's failure to determine his eligibility for this particular program, and also counsel's failure to do the same. As the motion court found, and this court should find, the motion court did not clearly err when they overruled his motion and that his guilty plea was rendered involuntary by these failures. Why? Because he failed to meet his burden at the evidentiary hearing to show that he was prejudiced, specifically prejudiced by the failures of both the trial court and his plea counsel. Specifically, he did not show that had he known if he was ineligible, that he was ineligible, and that's not in dispute, for this particular long-term treatment, that he would have insisted on going to trial rather than...
And that's guilty. The Strickland standard, but opposing counsel says that's the standard applicable to her ineffective assistance claim, she agrees, but not to her due process claim. Where is your case that says you apply Strickland to a due process claim?
Well, under both the points raised by appellant, they claimed that the guilty plea was rendered involuntary.
Yes, involuntariness, but this prejudice, having to show prejudice from that you would have not pled guilty or... And that the court could make that credibility determination, as opposed to she's saying her client was promised a certain sentence and that the judge was required by law to make sure that was a lawful sentence, and the judge failed to do that, and that was the premise of the plea of guilty. And I don't think the trial court found that wasn't true. He just found, well, it wouldn't have made any difference. But why do we need that extra step in the due process context?
Well, in Hill versus Lockhart, still controls in the context of a claim. This is brought in a post-conviction claim about it. It's still a claim that his guilty plea was rendered involuntary. The sentence was not in, I know the appellant's claim in the discussion prior was that his guilty plea, or I'm sorry, his sentence was unauthorized.
Well, it was, right? He could not sentence. The judge legally had to make sure he could be sentenced to that long-term drug treatment program, and he did not meet the qualifications, so he was not permitted to be sentenced to that under the statute. The court can only impose that sentence once it determines that he's eligible per the statute. Is that correct?
I'm not certain that that means that the sentence was unauthorized. It meant that, like a number of these other cases that were cited, like Taylor versus Moore, or the one that I think counsel mentioned in a letter yesterday, Nixon versus Campbell, perhaps in that case where through an occurrence, a decision by the state, it turned out that the defendant was not eligible for the program or could not continue in the program.
But here, why you're saying basically the legislature put in this requirement that the judge has to check before imposing that sentence, and you're saying, but we should ignore that and give it no effect if the judge doesn't do it. Isn't that ignoring the legislature's intent there?
Still has to prove prejudice, and that is defined by what was your, as given the opportunity of an evidentiary hearing, and the court determined whether his claim that he would have insisted on going to trial was credible.
Is there a case that applies that in the due process context in addition to in the ineffective assistance context? Because opposing counsel is drawing a distinction between the two and saying you're trying to apply Strickland to a due process claim, and that's not what the cases do. And I'd like your response to that.
I don't have a case that includes a claim that the sentence, because he was not placed, defendant was not placed in a program that he may have hoped or expected to be placed in, rendered it a due process violation, and thus a different analysis. The motion court found that his claim, as we stated, that he pleaded guilty in order to be placed in this treatment program was not credible. And in fact, this was not a arbitrary finding by the court. The court specifically pointed out that he received substantially less time than he potentially faced if he'd gone to trial, 5 to 15 years.
In this case, based upon his prior record, he would have had judge sentencing regardless.
Yes. Although, and there was evidence at the evidentiary hearing about what his situation would have been had he been placed in this treatment program as opposed to serving his time without the treatment program. His counsel testified that she informed him that if he'd been placed in the treatment program, and the statute, I'd refer the court to the statute 217.362, requires the treatment to last any time between 12 to 24 months. And however, once that the person who's enrolled, the defendant who's enrolled, is required to successfully complete that program, and then only then would the defendant be referred to the sentencing court to determine whether probation is appropriate. So there's another hurdle. Counsel testified that she advised her client that he would probably be, he would, and the and my understanding of the regulations accord or in accord with this, that he would be eligible for parole without the treatment within 2 years. This was a B felony, and generally that requires approximately 25% of a sentence served before a defendant is eligible for parole.
The finding of the trial, some of the findings of the trial court, or a particular finding of the trial court, is erroneous, even though the trial court is apparently attempting to make a finding as to the credibility of the defendant and the believability of his testimony, that he thought his plea bargain required the long-term treatment. And the trial court makes that finding based entirely on the fact that the defendant testified no one had promised him what his sentence would be. And that is that's not the same as whether or not it was represented to him that that was the plea bargain.
Now, Judge, are you referring to the motion court's finding that they are the one in the same court, but in its capacity as a motion court, they found that the
motion court found that that he testified no one promised him what his sentence would be, and therefore any belief that he would get long-term treatment is not believable.
I would note that in this case, and if I understand your question, it's whether does that contradict with the record from sentencing? And
right, because the trial court told him if the trial court didn't sentence him according to the plea bargain, he could withdraw his plea. So therefore, it certainly appears from the record it wasn't unreasonable for him to believe that he would have an opportunity for long-term sentence or for long-term treatment, because the court said if he didn't, he would withdraw the plea.
Well, the issue is of course, ultimately, as the state has put forth in its respondent's brief, is that he did not demonstrate prejudice. He may have hoped, and I believe the motion court noted that, hoped he would be placed in treatment, but that the primary motivator for him to plead guilty was to get a substantially lesser sentence.
Why didn't, in Nixon v. Campbell, he was given a chance to withdraw his plea. Why would we let the court decide whether he would withdraw it? Here he's trying to withdraw it. I mean, why not give him that opportunity, which is what
I believe Judge Powell had pointed out. I think there's perhaps the two cases are analogous in the sense that Judge Powell mentioned. In Nixon versus Campbell, ultimately the defendant did not prevail because he was given the opportunity to withdraw his guilty plea by the sentencing court before it went to habeas
in St. Louis. And chose not to do so.
And chose not to.
But this guy didn't have that opportunity here.
Well, he had an opportunity to demonstrate that he would have gone to trial had he known that he was not going to be enrolled in the treatment program. And the court, as the finder of fact, as the And of course, they are. This court has stated that they are in a superior position to determine the credibility.
So did the court say, if I don't accept your plea, you can, if you don't get this sentence, you can withdraw your plea? Had no meaning. It really was. It's being treated as an open plea and not as a specific plea agreement.
What the court stated that if the court announced it would follow the plea agreement. And I believe after that they said that the court did indicate that you would have a chance, you would withdraw your plea.
But he didn't get that chance.
He didn't withdraw his plea.
Did he have an opportunity to withdraw his plea?
Well, that was not a fact that was known before the court. Obviously, the court was unaware, counsel was unaware, presumably all parties were unaware that he was not eligible for this treatment program.
And I understand, but should we be affected here by the fact that the statute imposes on the judge the obligation to be aware?
Well, the statute is important, but in all cases analyzing under Rule 24035, you have to demonstrate Strickland prejudice as articulated under Hill versus Lockhart. And that's, that applies whenever you have a claim that's brought under Rule 2435. And in this case, he had the opportunity that all movements could be given. He had an opportunity to present evidence at the evidentiary hearing. The court had a good reason to believe you did not plead guilty because, but for the fact that you didn't get treatment, you would have gone to trial. Your motivating factor in pleading guilty was the lesser sentence, and given the fact that he understood if he'd gone to trial.
Thank you, counsel.
Yeah. What evidence in the record supports that finding by the trial court?
That
he would have gone to trial and he was motivated by a lesser plea.
Well, the facts.
A lesser sentence, pardon me.
Yeah, the record shows he was charged with DWI chronic offender. It was a Class B felony. He faced 5 to 15 years. There was, as is in every guilty plea, there was a recitation of the evidence presented. He agreed with it. So that's part of the record. He faced that.
Which is argued to be an objective determination by the trial court that someone in that circumstance would not have chosen to reject the plea.
Well, again, it's up to the court to make a determination of credibility. The appellant testified, this is what I would have done.
And didn't he in the colloquy say, I am in fact guilty?
Yes.
Say yes to that question? Of course.
The court accepted the guilty plea only after he agreed with the statement of facts.
And of course you're required to admit the facts in order to plead guilty or you can't accept the plea. But I think the question, if I understand Judge Brackmidge's question, it's that can you make a subjective determination based solely on objective facts? A reasonable person in this situation would do X, therefore it's not credible for you to say you wouldn't do X. I don't know of a case applying that reasoning.
Here, Mr. Williams had the burden of proving that he would have gone to trial had he known that he wasn't going to be placed into treatment.
And he said that.
He said that, but that was, if that were the case, if it was allegations, they're not self-proving. He had an evidentiary hearing, and the court had to determine, as with any witness and any evidence presented before it, whether it was credible, whether it was believable.
And did this record also included the lawyer testimony that indicated that he had advised the defendant that the release on parole would be about the same length of time as the probation, correct?
That's exactly what counsel testified to, and the facts of his particular case bear that out. The statute requires the program, if you're placed in the program, it's a minimum of 12 months, maximum of 24 months. You've got to successfully complete it. And only then are you referred to the sentencing court for possible eligible probation, if I may finish this question. And that's Judge Fisher, compared with not being placed in treatment but being eligible for parole after approximately 25%, after 25% of his 8-year sentence, which would be 2 years. If there are no further questions, we'd respectfully ask the court to affirm the motion court's denial of appellant's Rule 4035 claim. Thank you.
Is prejudice an element of a failure to get the benefit of your plea bargain claim?
I'm sorry, is what an element?
Is prejudice an element of a claim for failing to get the benefit of your plea bargain?
There has to be some prejudice, it's almost tautological. That's what this court's opinions have said, is that is the prejudice, is the failure to get the benefit of your bargain.
Well, that takes us back to the question we're not talking about. The judge thought he got the benefit of the bargain he made, which was that the trial judge would request long-term treatment, not that he would get long-term treatment.
Here's what the statute says, Your Honor.
No, I'm talking about what the motion court thought, the trial judge thought the plea bargain was, and what the motion court thought the defendant thought the plea bargain was. Not that he would get long-term treatment, but that the trial court would request it.
I don't think that is the plea bargain, Your Honor, and I don't think
You don't think that. I might not think that, but the motion court thought it, and aren't we bound by his reasonable conclusions, his reasonable findings of fact? Why isn't that a finding he can make?
That the plea bargain was to request long-term treatment because the record is clear.
He was to participate in long-term treatment if eligible. That's the finding.
Is not supported by the record, Your Honor. The plea
he says that it's supported by the word requests and by Williams' testimony. Why isn't that accurate?
Because we have the transcript of the plea.
You're distinguishing the judgment, which has requests, from the bargain, which did not have requests in it. I get this.
The plea bargain is set out in the plea transcript.
And is it reasonable to suppose he would have pled guilty to a bargain that included the judge asking for him to be given something in law he couldn't be given? I mean, the judge's finding that he just pled guilty to a request for it would have been premised on the idea that request could under law be granted, and here it could not be.
Could not. And the statute even says if the court finds out they're not eligible, then the court shall consider other dispositions. That's part of the statute as well. I mean, I've got another case just like this, pending in the Eastern District. Same judge, same attorney. This is a gotcha. They're sentencing people to something that they're not eligible for, and they're never checking to see if they're eligible or not. This court in Delft cited to the Brown v. Gammon case, which is an old Western District case, where the court was sentencing people to a higher sentence in exchange for 120 and then not giving them the 120 and guaranteeing them a release on 120. And Brown was released on a habeas for that very reason. The court has to follow the law. The court has to follow the statute, or it's an unlawful sentence.
What is the status of your client? Is he on parole now?
No, he's still incarcerated. And you know, there's, if I can finish really briefly, Judge Fisher.
I want you to finish.
Okay, because you all have talked a lot about whether he would have gotten out at the same time anyway, whether he went to long-term treatment or not. But there's benefits to long-term treatment other than just getting out of prison at a certain year or not. A lot of clients want long-term treatment because they want to get off drugs. There's benefits to the program itself. And so I just really want to make that point.
All right. And that actually gets to the question I was going to ask you about. What can be part of a binding plea agreement other than the sentence? In other words, the problem I see with your argument is there's the sentence, 8 years, that we all agree he received the benefit of. Everybody agrees to that. What else added on can really be part of a binding plea agreement? There might be legal impossibility. There might be factual impossibility. There may be bad motivation, as you suggest, but there may be all good motivation and things that are impossible to comply with. And at what point in time is that considered something outside what can be part of a binding plea agreement?
I think that's what this court was trying to address in that Delphi-Missy case, and I think I was trying to thread the needle between that and Nixon v. Campbell, because in Delph, this court talked about conditions of probation were not part of the sentence, that it was the sentence itself that could be part of the binding plea agreement. And that's one reason I tendered this memorandum as a supplemental legal file, because it has a section for sentence and a section for probation, and the long-term treatment statute is listed under the sentence as part of the sentence in that
but
memorandum.
But it's just a form,
so I don't know how controlling that is.
But my question, it gets right to the needle you're trying to thread, so I want you to have every opportunity to respond to this, is what really matters as to what is part of a sentence and what is a condition of probation? Surely it's not where it ends up in the judgment.
It's got to be something more than that, right?
So what actually tells us what's really part of a sentence? In other words, the particular jail, the particular prison, or is it any condition of probation?
I mean, we know it's not
conditions
of probation. At least that's what this court held in Delph. I really do think the difference in this case that distinguishes it from Delph is that this is whether you are going to be eligible for probation or not, not whether you're going to receive it. I think that is the distinction, and because the court didn't check for eligibility and because the trial attorney didn't check for eligibility, nobody knew it, and they made that part of the plea bargain, and they agreed to that, and everybody agreed at the plea colloquy that this was what he was pleading to, was long-term treatment.
But does that make it a part of the sentence?
I understand your argument that it makes it a part of the agreement. I don't know that I have a better answer for you than that.
Thank you.
Thank you.